Colossians 3:19-4:1, the 14th talk in a series on Colossians, was presented by Ron Julian on October 17, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Well, good morning. We're coming to the end, actually, of our study in Colossians. Not today, but within a couple weeks, we're going to make it into chapter 4 today, I think. We are in chapter 3. We started looking at a section that I see as starting in verse 17. And whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father. And then the set of instructions that he gives following, I understand to be a further development of that theme. He's demonstrating in various arenas what he means by doing everything in the name of the Lord. And the pairs of relationships that he describes, wives, husbands, children, fathers, slaves, masters, each one of those sets of relationships is one where, in Paul's view, there is a certain obligation on one side of the relationship to submit in a certain way to the person on the other side of the relationship, although there are different kinds of submission and different issues involved in each case. But in each of these situations, one of the parties has a certain higher claim to the submission of the other person in certain situations. The problem is that all of us being selfish, that the people on both sides of these relationships are inclined to conduct those relationships in a selfish way. The person who has a certain obligation to submit is inclined to fight that for their own sake, and the person who has the responsibility or the authority in the situation is inclined to misuse that selfishly. One side resists authority and the other abuses it, and that tends to be the pattern. The question that Paul's asking people to confront, as I understand it, is, what am I looking for? In this situation, what do I see as the goal? What am I trying to accomplish? If I'm looking out for the best deal I can get now, how can I make things right now as comfortable for me as I can, give me the most security, the most leverage so I can get my own way in the situation and so on, then I've got to make sure that I'm looking out for number one, and that means that if I am in the position where I'm supposed to submit, I'm going to be fighting that to get my way, and if I'm in the position where I have some authority, I'm going to use it to benefit myself because that's going to be of benefit to me. But maybe, perhaps, not perhaps, Paul is saying there ought to be something else in mind. As I enter into these relationships and think about how I'm going to conduct myself, there's something bigger that I'm looking for. I see that there's another person involved. It is my Creator. It is the one who made me. It is the one who has called me to live in a certain way. And what I'm seeking, ultimately, is His approval, because there is an inheritance tied to that. Where is life to be found? How am I going to find benefit and goodness for my own life? I'm going to find it at the hands of my Creator. So I can't conduct myself in the midst of these relationships as if He weren't there. Or if I do, I'm being very short-sighted. I may win against you, but I end up losing with the one that really counts. That's the logic of what Paul's talking about. Now, we talked about the most controversial of these last time, where he said, wives, be subject to your husbands. And I tried to spell out for you what I think the nature of the responsibility of the husband is, and thus what the nature of the obligation of a wife would be, what submission would look like and what it doesn't look like. But the key here is to understand that however we understand submission, however we put it together, the choice that the woman faces is, am I just dealing with what I can get from him, or am I dealing with God? Do I see myself as making these choices under the mastery of God? He's the one whose will I am seeking to do. And so in my relationship with my husband, I'm going to conduct myself in the name of God. I'm going to do this as if his will were at stake, as if he were the one who were calling me to do these things, because he is. And I tried to clarify last time the senses in which that is and is not true. Let's move on then to the other side of that pairing. In verse 19, husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. Okay, husbands, love your wives. Obviously, I think probably most of you know that that is not what it sounds like in our culture. To talk about loving your wife, it's very hard for us to hear that kind of language without thinking about romance. I mean, you know, we need to put some romance back in our marriage. You know, we want to rekindle the love that we have for each other and so on. Which is all fine. I'm not against romance, you understand. But that's not what Paul's talking about. I'm very, very convinced that when the Bible talks about loving other people, that what's at stake is my commitment to their welfare. After all, Jesus told us to love your enemies and do good for those who hate you. The idea is that even though you are my enemy, I am called upon to be, in a sense, on your side, to be looking out for your welfare. What's good for you ought to be significant to me, even if you're my enemy. Now, that's a mouthful, but it helps us to get the idea in that kind of sentence. By love your enemy, he's not really talking about my affections. He's not saying every time I think about this person who's trying to do me in, I feel all warm and cuddly inside. Because, I mean, you can imagine, it's just not possible. That would be calling, I think, for the impossible. I cannot think about my enemy without understanding the evil that they are seeking for me. I'm not being asked to forget that. But what I'm being asked to do is to remember, in spite of that, that I want good for them. If I could work it so that they could be restored from the evil place that they are in life, that, and blessing could come their way, that I would want it to happen. Okay, so love in that situation is not so much talking about my affections as it is talking about my commitment to the other person's welfare. So when husbands are being urged to love their wives, the key here is to understand that in a situation where he has just called upon the wife to submit to and recognize the responsibility that the husband has in the family, that the husband now is in response, is being urged not to use that situation for his own benefit, but to seek the good of his wife. It has always been true that when there is cultural support, which there usually is, for the idea of male headship, that men use it as a way to get what they want and end up, rather than seeking the good of their wives, use it as a way to make sure that, first of all, they get what they're looking for. I mean, the rap against the idea of male headship in our own age has been fueled by some bad thinking, but it has also been fueled by some good thinking. It has been fueled by a recognition that when men have the idea that they're the head of the house, that they use that to benefit themselves and to ignore the needs of the rest of their family. I mean, you know, the classic picture of the idea of male headship, and some of you are probably not old enough to remember the Honeymooners, Jackie Gleason, Audrey Meadows, you know, Ralph comes strutting into the place talking about how, you know, he's the king of his castle, you know, he's kind of pointing to himself, you know, I'm the king, you know, what I say goes, you're going to do what I say, and that sort of thing. And of course, she, in response, you know, gives it back to him as good as he's given it. That, you know, always threatening that he's going to, you know, to the moon, Alice, you know, he's going to punch her, and of course, she says the same thing back to him. Somehow this has become our picture of what male headship is all about. I get my way because I'm king around here. And if we don't say it that way, we still, because we are selfish human beings, anybody who is in a position where they can benefit themselves at the expense of others is inclined to do it. We're just, with the best will in the world, we are inclined to benefit ourselves at the expense of others. My understanding of what Paul is getting at for the husband is to say, in essence, I don't care what your situation is as head of this house, you are called upon to love, to seek the benefit of, to sacrifice yourself for your wife. He says, don't be embittered against her. I'm not sure that's the best way to translate it. It's a possible way to translate it. It also seems possible to me that it's more like, do not treat her harshly. Do not be harsh with her, which actually makes a little more sense to me in this situation. To not use my advantage in a way to benefit me and be harsh toward her. Now, obviously we all have a calling from God to love other people, to seek the good of other people. The great commandment, the pair of them, love God. The other one is to love my neighbor as myself. So I have an obligation to love every single human being that I encounter. And I have an obligation to love my enemy, even, as we were talking about. There is a unique sense in which, because of what Christ means to me, that you as my brother, my sister in Christ, means something to me, and I am called upon to love you. So there's a sense in which there's nothing unique about what Paul is saying here. I am called upon to seek the welfare of and sacrifice myself for other people. That's my calling in life. That's your calling in life. But I think it's not insignificant that Paul seeks to uniquely say to the husband that you should love your wife, because it is so easy for a person who has any sort of prior privilege in a relationship to read the situation and use it for selfish gain. It's just really easy to do. In Ephesians, Paul uses the example of Christ. Be the head of your wife the way Christ was the head of the church. He died on a cross for her. I mean, the idea being you have a responsibility to seek the welfare of your wife. You have this responsibility to seek the welfare of everyone. But just because you have a certain responsibility that gives you a certain authority in the family does not mean that you have been exempted from the responsibility to love. The fact is that your authority doesn't give you the right to get your way. You have a calling to seek, sacrificially seek, her welfare. She too has a responsibility to sacrificially seek your welfare. Each of us as believers has a responsibility to seek each other's welfare. But in a relationship where one is called by God to submit in certain senses and in certain ways, the other party needs to be all the more reminded, this is not about you winning. This is about you serving. This is about you giving. Margaret? Well, really, I tried to address that side of it last time when I talked about the nature of the submission that the wife is called to. As I see it, the situation is one where submission is a recognition of responsibility. So to answer specifically what you're saying, I don't believe that God gave headship to the man because the woman was incapable of thinking for herself, or she's emotional and not rational, or those kinds of things. And I think any man who's being honest with himself and seeking to understand the person that he is married to will come to recognize that that's not true. It's not true that I have the responsibility because I know how to do it and she doesn't. I mean, it doesn't work that way. So it is not because she is incapable of thinking for herself, but rather it is a recognition that there is a sphere in which the mutual decisions made by this family ultimately come under the responsibility of the husband. Another way in which what I'm saying speaks to what you're saying is that when a husband is saying, here's what you ought to think, here's what you ought to read, the idea that he is her spiritual director and that he understands and she doesn't, and so she needs to do what he says in that area, I would see that as a misunderstanding of the notion of headship, because it is a misunderstanding of his responsibility. That is, what you're going to believe, what you're going to read, what you're going to think, who you're going to talk to, those are personal decisions that no other human being can make for me. Nobody can form my beliefs for me. I'm responsible before God for what I believe and what I think. And so I can't call upon my wife to submit to my beliefs as an act of submission to me as a husband, because I am overstepping my authority. I have no authority to dictate that to her. I, as a believer, can say to her, this is what I believe to be true, and I can call upon her to believe it in the name of the authority of the Bible. But in that regard, she has just as much authority as a believer to turn around to me and call on me to believe something appealing to the authority of the Bible. So, you're right. I can't connect the idea of love with the idea of micromanaging the beliefs and attitudes and actions of my wife, because as much as I might be doing it beneficently, I have in fact overstepped my authority. And her response to me in that situation then is not dictated by, I would say, if she correctly understands the situation, her response is not going to be dictated by a belief that she has to submit to my authority, because I have no authority to say that. Her response is going to be dictated by what does she think is the right thing to do in this situation? What is most loving for me? What is taking on the responsibility that she has as a unique individual to believe the truth and follow the truth and make the decision as best she can? How am I going to respond to what is, in essence, an unjust command on the part of my husband.
In the sense that being not cruel was loving him for her, maybe loving her to accede to his commands, at least for a while, not to be this brother, not to be this person, not to go to this church, and attempting to engage him in dialogue, to persuade him.
Right. But then equally, it may come to the point where she decides that, in fact, the loving thing to do is to not go along with this anymore. To say, the fact is, I need to make it clear there's something bad happening here. You're going the wrong way. And the most loving thing I can do is to make it clear to you that that's the case. So, yeah, it's not... If we just make... something like submission, if we just take and turn it into the rule and make it the absolute, then we have really missed the point, and we're not really being obedient to what God has called us to. We're just contenting ourselves that we're keeping some rule. I mean, the fact is, there are times when it's appropriate to hang in there with a person and try to see them through, to try to meet them where they are and walk them along, and there are times when it's appropriate to shut the door and say no more. I'm not helping you by going along with this anymore. I'm done. And that too can be a loving thing to do. So it's not like there's this rule. He's your husband, he said to do it, so do it. Because as I talked about last time, I mean, we have instructions in the Bible to submit to the civil authorities, and then examples of people not submitting to the civil authorities. It's not just a rule. The civil authorities say it, you do it, that's the rule. The idea is that there is a principle among a series of principles that I am trying to hold fast to, and the situation is going to determine whether at this point I should do this thing or this thing. The warning, though, is I am inclined to dismiss the claims of husbands, of civil authorities, of parents, of employers, of masters, whoever, out of a desire to just do what I want. And what Paul is saying is I need to ask the question, what am I going to do here, in the light of what my ultimate master wants, and not just this person that I may be able to hoodwink and get away with something here. I may be able to bend you to my will, but I'm not going to bend God to my will, so what am I going to do with him? That's in the essence of it. Okay, so my understanding on Paul's emphasis here is not even so much on the act itself. It's not, hey wives, submit. Hey children, be obedient. Yes, he's saying that, but the thing behind it is this idea that I am acting in the name of the Lord. Okay, now, there's a second set of relationships that he describes, children and parents. He says, children, be obedient to your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. The obligation of children to obey is related again to the prior responsibility of the parents. My understanding is I should see myself as a parent, and as a child I should see my parents as having a responsibility given them by God. It's a natural one. It's an easy one to understand. Children need to be taken care of. They need to be taught. They need to be corrected. They need to be loved. They need to be nurtured. They need somebody helping them out. Because you just don't have it together just right off the bat. The fact is that children are vulnerable. They are incredible creations of God with minds that are amazing, but minds that are still very much unformed and in need of discipline, correction, instruction, good example, support. As a child gets old enough to understand who God is, I see Paul as saying essentially that even as children, they face a choice. I can deal with my parents with the attitude, my goal is to get away with as much as I can, which sounds pretty good, actually. I mean, I think most kids, that would be, I have to say to my shame that I was one that took that attitude towards my parents. I wasn't a believer at all, but my attitude was basically what they didn't know wouldn't hurt them and wouldn't hurt me. So what's that thing about treated them like mushrooms, kept them in the dark and shoveled a lot of manure? That was my attitude towards my parents. Well, I didn't in that situation, I know myself, I was under no submission to any other guide or authority except what I wanted. But there is another issue. Do I recognize that there is a right out there? Do I recognize that God is who He is, that God gave a responsibility for my welfare to my parents, and that I acknowledge that responsibility? I think that this is not an unrealistic thing. I think that children actually can and do wrestle with questions like this, that they come to be real moral agents at a fairly young age, and that it's not unrealistic to confront them with the rights and wrongs of their obedience to their parents. But of course, as in all of these relationships, Paul talks to the other side as well. Fathers, do not exasperate your children, that they may not lose heart. Do not provoke, make resentful. That's kind of the idea. Now, I just have to say, I have a couple of good kids, I think, but I am absolutely aware that I have not done everything the way I ought to have done it along the way. It is very easy. It is very, very easy in a day-by-day relationship with an energetic, willful, young, spirited person to use your power in a way that serves yourself. I believe in discipline, but I have seen the difference in myself between discipline that is seeking to educate, seeking to train, seeking to build up ultimately the kid, or discipline that is just basically my own impatience. I don't want to be bothered with you, so I'm going to use my authority to make you go away. A lot of the bossing around that we as parents do is really about us, and we just need to admit it. I know that it's true, and I'm ashamed of the fact that it is true, and I trying to fight it in myself, but I know that it's true. I have the upper hand, and I use it. Who wouldn't? If you have the upper hand and you're tired, I mean, you know, it's hard. I'm sympathetic. I'm willing to cut myself some slack in a certain sense, you know. You're working hard and you have a lot of things to do, and you think of a lot of the things that you're doing as being for the welfare of your children. And so in the middle of that, your kids come pushing at you in 10 more ways that they want you to do something for them. And, you know, your attitude is, I think the first 10 or 15 were enough. I'd kind of like to stop now. And so, instead of responding in that situation, here's an opportunity to serve my child by helping them, maybe by talking to them about what is and isn't appropriate, helping them to shape their own expectations of me. I mean, there's a lot of different things you could do. My response instead is, I want mine, and I can get it easily because I have the upper hand here. So now, I'm not talking theoretically. I am not making up some straw man kind of deal here. I'm speaking absolutely from experience. This is a difficult thing to do. Being a parent is a difficult thing to do. And I know every parent I have ever known has screwed up in their dealing with their kids. And some of them, by the grace of God, have the grace to recognize that it's been the case. What Paul is saying here is that just as if I'm going to call on my child to obey out of submission to the truth, out of a recognition that God has given me a responsibility, then I have the responsibility to submit to God in the way I carry out that responsibility. It is a responsibility to nurture, train, teach. It is not the right to get my way. There's a difference. And so the same thing that is true in a certain arena and in a certain sense between a husband and a wife, I think is much, much more an issue with parents and children. In my experience, and now this could just be my experience, but Robbie and I believe very much in the notion of male headship, but it is actually most of the time pretty much a moot issue. It's just not something that comes up very much. It's just sort of, it's a framework within which we conduct ourselves, but it doesn't, it's not the card that either of us play very often. But the responsibility of a parent for a child and the choice that a child faces, whether he or she is going to submit to that responsibility, is an ongoing, day-by-day, minute-by-minute relationship. It just, you never escape it. And so each of the parties here is being called upon to make their decisions in the light of their relationship to God. Children, you're not just dealing with your parents. And parents, it doesn't matter what you can get away with, how much power you have in the situation. The fact is that both of you are answerable to God. Both of you are answerable to what is right. I like the way Paul describes this. Do not provoke your children that they may not lose heart. The fact is that I so have the upper hand that if I choose to abuse my situation and call upon them, push them to obey, nag them, get at them in such a way that I really am not fulfilling my responsibility but just gratifying myself, what can they do? They're going to lose heart eventually, because where can they go? They've got to deal with me. So a godly relationship between parents and children would be one where both of them recognize their responsibility before God, that both of them are answerable to God for not being selfish and short-sighted in the relationship. He does not say, parents and children, if you're both believers, you all should just obey Jesus, so parents, stop telling your children what to do, and children, don't obey your parents, just obey God. He acknowledges the rightness, the appropriateness, that God is pleased with a situation where a parent takes responsibility for a child and a child submits to that responsibility by obeying. That relationship, as we see all too often, can end up being a perversion and ugly. If I think of myself as a parent as the one who's got the right to tell my kid what to do. And there's a third pairing of relationships that Paul talks about, slaves and masters. He says in 22, slaves, in all things obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Now it's striking to me, we'll talk about this a little bit, but it's a very difficult subject, but the fact is that Paul doesn't really strike at the institution of slavery in what he says here. He doesn't denounce it as immoral or anything like that. Now, at this point in history, my understanding would be that the institution of slavery in the Roman Empire is much more humane than it was when it started, and probably much more humane than slavery as we knew it in the United States was. It was not exactly the same thing. It was actually quite common, as I understand it, for slaves in one way or another to buy their freedom. But still, the fact is that your parents might have been conquered by the Romans in battle, taken as slaves, and you were born into slavery and essentially just grew up as a slave with no choice about the matter at all. Of all the relationships Paul discusses, here's one which is is particularly characterized by a power relationship. The master has got the right to tell you what to do. That's the whole idea. You're my servant. The master, in this situation, the master's responsibility is not to train the servant up into adulthood like a parent with a child. The servant's responsibility is to do the job for the master. Yet, Paul calls for obedience. He says, not with, literally it's a word, it's kind of eye service. The idea is, it's that sort of service that I give when you're looking. I'm going to do this, I'm going to make it look like I'm doing what I'm supposed to do so that I won't get in trouble. But inside, my attitude is, I don't want to have anything to do with this, and to the extent that I can push at it and not do what I've been told to do and get away with it, I'm going to. There's a great tradition, I think, of comedies about underlings who serve with eye service, you know, who basically present the picture of themselves as obedient and submissive all the time, totally subverting everything behind the scenes. I think of, again, I'm showing my age. I really am showing my age, but if anyone remembers, not the stupid movies that came out recently, but like Sergeant Bilko, you remember that, the TV series from years ago, or McHale's Navy, or that kind of thing. There was a movie with Marlon Brando called Tea House of the August Moon, where he plays an interpreter who, very, very submissive, bowing, oh yes, boss, all the time, when actually he's in total control of the situation and is absolutely manipulating everything to make it so that he gets what he wants. It's very funny. I mean, it can be very funny. Well, that's what Paul is in essence warning servants not to do. He's calling them to serve from the heart, fearing the Lord. And the fear of God is a central theme in the Bible. The idea being that I recognize that my destiny, my welfare, is in the hands of God. I can serve with eye service if I fear my master. My master, my earthly master, can give me a lot of trouble if I don't at least look like I'm obeying. So I had better look like I'm obeying. But if I fear God, I recognize it doesn't really matter ultimately what my earthly master thinks of me. There's another whose opinion is much more valuable. Remember, Jesus said, don't fear the one who all he can do is kill you. As strange as that sounds. All he can do is kill you. Well, yeah, because there's another who can do worse. You ought to fear the God who can cast both body and soul into hell. Fear, not as in abject terror, because it is coupled with trust. I trust the God who has said that he loves me and is reaching out for me. So it's not fear as in I don't know what to think of him, I'm afraid he's going to strike me down. I know him from what he has told me about himself and what he has shown me. Nonetheless, who am I going to fear in life is the question. Am I worried about what you can do, or am I worried about ultimately how God thinks of me? And so the slave in this situation is being asked, who do you fear? Your service is not ultimately to your master, your service is to God. And again, it's not that everything my master says is somehow he's God to me, and so I'm doing it because God's will is being expressed through what he says. I don't mean that. But God has called me as a slave to do the right thing. And the right thing is to fulfill my responsibility to my master. Whatever you do, do your work heartily. As for the Lord, rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. At stake is my inheritance. I am striving to enter into eternal life and blessing. So my decision about how I'm going to conduct myself is not just what I'm going to do with you, my master, who can see me at certain times. But the issue is, What am I going to do in relationship to my Creator, who sees me always, who knows me better than I know myself? How am I going to decide what to do with Him? He says in 25, "For he who does wrong will receive the consequences of the wrong which he has done, and that without partiality." And that without partiality is the key. Today, it may be that I'm the slave and you're the master. And in that relationship, I have a certain obligation to you that you don't have to me. I'm being called upon to obey your commands, and you're not being called upon to obey mine. But there is no partiality. There is a judgment coming where if I have submitted to God's will, I will find blessing. And if you have been rebellion against God's will, you will find judgment. You will receive the consequences of the wrong that you have done. There is no partiality. If it was switched around, if you had done right before God and I was a rebel, then I would receive the consequences of the wrong done. But the idea is that each of you, each of us, I the slave, you the master, individually are making choices about what we think about God, what we think about His claim on our life. And then finally, he talks to the other side of the pair again. "Masters, grant to your slaves justice and fairness, knowing that you too have a master in heaven." Once again, now he talks to the one who has the, quote, power in the situation. "Masters, you do not have a blank check. You are answerable to God as well. Your slave is not just a piece of property, a means to your personal gain. He is your servant, but he is a human being, and God is calling upon you to deal with him with justice and fairness." Now, we could ask the question whether Paul ultimately is sort of asking the question that introduces the crack that ultimately will destroy the institution of slavery. Because if the master starts asking the question, what is it that is just and fair in my dealing with the servant, then it may call into question the very notion of an enforced employment. And as I said, it was actually quite common in the time, at any rate, for a slave to work his way out of slavery. What is clear, I think, what's on Paul's mind is the choice of the individual. He's not speaking to the institution, he's speaking to the individuals who are in the midst of the institution. How do I think about the God that has a claim on my life? The slave is going to conduct himself thinking about the mastery of God. The master is going to conduct himself thinking about the mastery of God. So, the point in this whole section, the idea is that we are to be living in all our relationships in God's name, to be thinking about the choices I make as if they were being made not just regarding you, the people that I have in front of me, but that God's will is at stake. I'm doing what I'm doing not just because I can't get out of it, because you've got the upper hand, but because I submit to God, and I believe in this situation what He wants from me is to submit. So my submission ultimately is not so much to you as it is to the claim that God has on my life. I really do believe that that's the beginning place for Paul. That ultimately, his concern was with the individual choice of the human being to submit to the claim of God on his life. When it comes to slavery, he did acknowledge that if a slave could get free, that would be a fine thing to do, and he should do it. But if he couldn't, then he should submit to his slavery and serve as if he were serving God. Do This is the life that he is called to. This is the situation that God has put him in, and so he should act in a way that reflects his giving to his master. Onesimus, a slave who ran away and became a Christian, Paul sent him back. And he wrote a letter to his master, who was also a Christian. And he said, in essence, look, Onesimus has become a believer. He has become very valuable to me. He has been a great help here. He's been serving me when you're not here. But I leave it up to you. What are you going to do? You could free him, let him go where he chooses, or you could make your claim, which you still have as his master, and call him back into service. Make your decision as a believer. Make your decision as one who cares about what God cares about. And ultimately, I think he was very strongly hinting, let him go. But he doesn't say so. He leaves the decision in Philemon's hands. Because the key for Paul is, individually, Onesimus had made the right choice. He was submitting to God, acknowledging God's existence, accepting his grace, learning what was true and right, and he was going back. He himself was choosing to go back to a situation that he was out of because he wanted to do what was right. And Paul was calling likewise on Philemon to do what was right. His concern, it always starts with that individual choice. And not even so much the action that results from that choice, but the heart of submission to God that brings that choice forth. The key is to start by understanding what's true. Who are you, a sinner? What has God done for you? He's brought you grace and is rescuing you from sin and death. Is that true? Yes, it is. Does God care about what I do in this life? Yes. He loves justice and mercy and compassion. So, all of those things being true, what are you going to do? These pairings that he describes here are just arenas in which I face the question, what do I think about God? Do I think he's there? Do I think that his inheritance, the inheritance that he's offered me, is worth having? Is that where life is to be found? If it is, then I'm going to make decisions that may seem to be on the short term against my interests. But in the long term, they are very much in my interest because they're in your interest. And when I'm serving you, I'm serving the God who very much cares about compassion and kindness and self-sacrifice. Okay. So there's a lot we could talk about with this stuff. We've got, I guess, about 15 minutes. We could talk about some things. Thank you. We can hear you much better if we wait for the mics. Thanks.
I was down south last weekend, so I don't know if you already addressed this, but did you give examples, or could you, if you didn't last time, of what it looks like to seek specific concrete examples of what you mean when you say to seek the welfare of your marriage partner, that would be the goal? And I think you said the goal of both spouses, but
right.
You gave a couple of examples of things that you didn't think it meant.
Right.
But what do you think it does look like?
Okay, well, let me see, what can I say? The problem is, it could look like a lot of different things. In general, what I'm saying is, I have to start with a picture of what real goodness would look like. So, You know, it's so much easier to talk about this in a negative. That is, you know, I could think as a parent, if I give my kid all the candy and sweets that he wants, he'll be really happy and like me. And that might seem like a good thing. But I learn after a while that if I do that, the short-term benefits do not outweigh the long-term liabilities of living that way. So I'm not really accomplishing good. So my first step is to try to understand what real goodness for another person would look like. That being the case, then, I want to love them as I love myself. What would I want to be done for me if the situation were reversed? So, seeking the welfare of my spouse might mean, although I live in a culture where the picture is one that, since I'm the head, I get my way, seeking the welfare of my spouse might mean a willingness to sacrifice my desires to, as much as possible, if there is not some greater good that I'm letting go, to give over the choice to the other one. Now, I mean, this may seem silly, but see, I'm making this up as I go along, so you forgive me for being all over the map here, but my experience in my marriage and in talking to a number of people in their marriage is that it is not at all uncommon for one of the partners in the marriage to be more concerned with the ambiance of their life, how the house looks, what colors are used, how things are arranged, that kind of stuff. And at the risk of sounding like a sexist, most of the time, in my experience, it is the wife who cares more about those things than the husband does. Let's just suppose that it's true in my relationship, absolutely. You can enter into the process of making those decisions in two ways. You can enter into that process with an attitude of, if I let her do it the way she wants to do it, then she wins. Now, believe me, there are a lot of guys who are competitive enough that basically their attitude is going to be, I can't let her win. That would be, I'm losing face here. I'm not being the head that I'm supposed to be. Versus having an attitude of, with this kind of decision, something that doesn't mean much to me and means a great deal to her, why shouldn't I encourage her to do it the way she wants to do it? Now, lest I be misunderstood, let me make clear when I describe this as a him-her sort of thing, that I am not in any way implying that somehow I'm condescendingly, letting the little missus have her concerns, which are obviously not worthy of a grown-up, mature, intelligent person, but I'm going to go along with it anyway. I say that very specifically because, again, to my shame, I have to say that probably when I first got married, that was my attitude. And I felt superior every time that Robbie would raise an issue of how things were in our house. I would feel superior inside, like I am above such things. And someday I'm going to raise her to my level where she is no longer concerned with these mundane things. I have come to see over the years that I was very, very mistaken in that attitude, and that her concern for those things is very much a concern that is worth the consideration of an intelligent, thoughtful, godly person. It is something worth thinking about. It is something worth doing something about. So I don't at all mean that in any sort of condescending way. Nonetheless, it's true that I can live with a lot. I mean, I don't pay that much attention to those things. So, to seek the welfare of the other person would mean things like, I'm willing to recognize the significance, if that is something that the other person is interested in making a contribution in our family, it is seeking that person's welfare to encourage them to pursue that. It is seeking that person's welfare to be interested in what they're doing. It's seeking that person's welfare to not to recognize that I can give them something. I can give them a small thing, but it is something by letting them chart the course for this. Seeking the other person's welfare at the same time can look the other way. For both husband and wife, seeking the other person's welfare can mean there is something wrong and somebody needs to say something and I'm going to say it. Seeking the other person's welfare can mean there's something you need to hear and I'm going to try to help you see what that is. So it's not seeking the other person's welfare has the potential to involve a great deal of self-sacrifice because I'm willing, in a choice between two goods, I'm willing to let you have the good that you're seeking instead of me getting the good that I'm seeking. And when the option comes up of whether something hard needs to be said, I'm going to care about you enough to say it rather than being unwilling to, you know, have any friction and stir the waters up. So it can look a lot of different ways from my perspective. What I was trying to get at in answer to Margaret's question is we need to think about this on a whole different basis, though. The Christian culture around us, as well as just culture in general, as well as just human experience in general, has tended to hand us a picture of what headship in a marriage would look like that is based on somehow on privilege. The biblical concept of headship is based on principle. And without the whole set of principles, that principle by itself doesn't mean anything. You know, for me to boss my wife around, I can't say, well, at least I got it 50% right. I may not be loving her, but at least I am the head. No, I got it 100% wrong because the concept of headship is really the concept of two people in mutual submission to the claims of God for what is right. And if I'm in rebellion against what is right, it doesn't matter whether I'm given the orders, and it doesn't matter if the other person is in rebellion against what is right. It doesn't matter if they submit. That's not the relationship that's being described. So there are material goods, there are spiritual goods, I think. And in both situations, as far as I can see, many times, in order to seek the other person's good, it means a putting aside, a temporary putting aside of my immediate gratification in order to accomplish a deeper purpose. Well, you know, that's the essence of Christian ethics. And it's the place where we all fall down. Roger?
In my experience, if you substitute the employer for the master, mm-hmm. you end up, I mean, Paul segregated them into three different categories, but if you're like me, you live those three categories all at the same time. Mm-hmm. You have a master, you have somebody you're working for, mm-hmm. you have a wife whom you're trying to love, and you have kids. And mm-hmm. sometimes the three come into, I mean, there's a balancing yes. act there.
Right, right.
Would you have anything to say about them all three together? And would you say that Paul would have some kind of a priority? whom do I, if it means loving my wife, that I have to do something against my employer, do I? Which way do I go? Would you have anything to say about
My initial advice was going to be just don't ever let them get together. But I'm not sure. I have one thing to say. This makes sense to me right now. The institution of marriage in Genesis is described with that very evocative language about the man leaving father and mother, cleaving to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And as I understand what's being talked about there right now, the idea is, in essence, two lives coming together as one. If I'm understanding the nature of the claim that's being made there, then I think I am being called upon to seek to become, to bring our two lives together into one with my wife. Which means then, I think in a certain sense, she has a prior claim. That is, as I look at how I'm going to conduct myself, and as she looks at how she's going to conduct herself, each of us has a responsibility to seek to come together, to make our life together work. And so there are ways in which other claims that may come upon me, if I feel like they're driving a wedge into that oneness, then I think I probably would say, I need to prioritize here and make this the most important thing. Certainly that's true. We need to guard ourselves, I think, against making other things in our life more important than the person we're married to. That's something that we need to strive to work against. Now, ideally, I think our two lives coming together as one would come to be such that we could come to have a meeting of the minds on what's important to us, that the one life that we are becoming, that we care about our children and we care about keeping our commitments to our employers and those sorts of things, so that we could agree together. I'm trying not to put a claim on you that interferes with your being able to fulfill your responsibility to your children and to your employer. At the same time, though, recognizing that we're seeking to keep those commitments with the idea that we are in this together. So it could go on both sides. I think there could be a place where together we would say, no, rather than doing this thing, this weekend trip together that we were going to do, it would be better for you to stay and take our kid out on a trip instead, because you really need to talk to her about this stuff and she really needs you right now. The two, husband and wife, could together say, this is the responsibility that we have and this is how we're going to fulfill it. It's not like because our being one is the most important, that means that we always win over everybody else. We always get to go off together and you take care of yourself. That's not necessarily the case. But on the other hand, there may be those places where my spouse could rightly say, I feel like you have taken the difficult task of coming together with me and put it aside and gone for the easier, more gratifying task of becoming one with your computer or your job or whatever it might be. You know, and so in that sense then I would have an obligation to listen to that and say, no, you and I are in this together and I need to be responsible to that. So when you start to talk about the mutual claims that things have on my life, it's not an easy choice. It's not like there's just one rule. Okay, you do it like this. I think all mature ethical decisions are made recognizing kind of a hierarchy of values. And the best that we can say is, I think, that becoming one with my... I am not called upon to become one with you the way I am called upon to become one with my wife. So in that sense, I need to seek unity with you and unity with my wife on different terms. And I'm trying as best as I can to understand what that would look like, and not always succeeding, but trying to acknowledge both claims. Yes, one more.
You may have already answered this question in many ways, but those of us who are dealing with older parents, children to parents, and those parents may not always be making decisions in their best welfare, how do you keep that honor? How do you keep that place without, when you might have to say, I'm sorry, you cannot drive the car anymore, kind of thing? It's disgusting.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a very good question, and I don't know. All I can say is, again, I would speak to that as, like I've been saying with other things, it's not like there's a rule. It's not like there's something that says, okay, you're supposed to obey your parents, so that means X. You can't ever say this, or you can't ever do that. It just doesn't work that way. The idea is that I ought to honor my parents as those who have for a long time been fulfilling a responsibility toward me, that they gave a lot of themselves to make my life work, and that that anyone who would dishonor that sort of thing is perverted. They're not understanding the way things are. But at the same time, I am called upon to love. And if I think my parent is in danger of bringing great suffering upon himself or herself, it is not dishonoring. It is not dishonoring to love them enough to seek to protect them from bad choices. At that point, though, I think I have to make that decision the same way I would regarding a lot of different people. I'm having to weigh, you know, how far am I going to go? Would it be better to just speak my mind and then back off? Or has it come to the point where I need to do something? Those are not, I mean, there's no rule in here anywhere that says how you make that decision. It's just, again, if I am trying to recognize those realities, honoring my parent as my parent and loving them the way I would try to love any other human being, then I'm on the right track, and the decision I make is going to be the best I can in that circumstance. It would be a lot easier if we just... There are churches you could go to where they would have the answer for you. They would tell you, here's what you're supposed to do. And I don't think it works that way. But that's the playing field, you know. I can tell you that the knights go up two squares and go over to the right, and that the bishops run along diagonally. There is a certain structure to the game, but there are a lot of different ways that you can play it, and a lot of different situations where, in one case, you ought to move that bishop, and in another case, you ought to leave it right where it is. So that's how I look at that. Okay, we're late. Robbie is in there with the kids, so I'm sure she wants me to stop.